their organs. They get rid of their choirs. So you have a tiny little Reformed Baptist movement in this country of about 24 dead musicless churches.
Because if you have any wavering in your confidence about the integrity of your translation of the Bible, it'll suck the conviction right out of your heart.
And that leads to some very interesting, heretical, and very important conclusions.
Hello and welcome to Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. Today is Monday, July the 9th of 2018. I trust that you had a good Lord's Day yesterday. I certainly did. Enjoyed being with the brethren at Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa. I was able to preach, had the privilege, the honor of standing and preaching on in the morning, John 11. We're in a series through the Gospel of John, and of late we've been looking at John 11, the raising of Lazarus, and I got to preach on that. It was a privilege to do that, and then in the afternoon, we were able to preach on the doctrine of effectual calling, chapter 10, paragraph 1 of our Second London Baptist Confession of Faith. I'm doing a series in the afternoons through the confession, and I've also found that to be encouraging, and I've really appreciated getting to understand and know the confession better. Well, in this episode of Word Magazine, I'm going to be returning to a kind of an oldie but a goodie. We're going to be looking again at the topic of the ending of Mark, sometimes called the longer ending of Mark. I really prefer to call it the traditional ending of Mark. That's Mark 16. Verses 9 through 20. And of course, it's one of the two most disputed texts in the New Testament, the other being John 7:53 through 8:11, the passage of the woman taken in adultery or the pericope adulteri. So those are the two most disputed. But I've done a number of things on the ending of Mark. Quite frankly, I think it's just one of the passages that has been contested by modern text criticism that's most easily defended. I think there's every reasonable reason to defend the originality and the authenticity of the original ending of the ending of Mark, the traditional ending of Mark, as the proper ending for the second gospel. So some of you know that I wrote an article actually on the ending of Mark as a canonical crisis. It began as a paper that I did at a theology conference at Houston Baptist University in the spring of 2017. And then I worked that into an academic article that appeared in Puritan Reformed Journal in January of this year, January 2018. I think it's volume 10, number 1. And by the way, I'll put a link up there to the PDF of my article if you want to read it or reread it, review it. I continue to hear from people who have read that article and who have listened to an audio version of the paper presentation I did in Houston, and they tell me that they have been encouraged by it. Some people have been influenced by it, and so I'm appreciative of that. Let me just share one recent note that I got. This is a brother in Southeast Asia, and I'll just keep his identity anonymous, you know, protect his identity. Might not want his name or his country being noted. But anyways, he sent me this message on my academia.edu site after he had downloaded and read my article on the ending of Mark as a canonical crisis. And he said, Dr. Jeff, thank you very much for this article that you have uploaded. I had watched your interview on YouTube on Megiddo Radio about the Greek text of the New Testament, and it helped me a lot to get rid of my confusion regarding which Greek text is more accurate or godly. There are many explanations that I've heard on both sides, the TR, the Textus Receptus, and the CT, the critical text, and that really got me into confusion. I went to a seminary before, still not finished, and my professors told me about textual criticism, and it's hard for me to accept everything they are saying. He even told us that the book of Ephesians was not written by Paul, ? So here's a fellow who has been to a seminary. Apparently he's been to a seminary that is quite enveloped in the environment of modern historical criticism. And this is not something strange. Even if you go to an supposedly evangelical seminary, the people who are teaching Bible courses are going to be people who probably got PhDs at accredited universities, where even though it might have been an evangelical school, they were rooted in modern historical criticism, influenced by the Enlightenment. And to think that this brother was going to probably an evangelical school, and the professor was, according to this fellow's account, questioning the authenticity of Ephesians. Now, I mean, if you're teaching an academic class in the New Testament, you should certainly learn that the authorship of Ephesians has been challenged in the post-Enlightenment modern historical critical period. When I teach a survey of the New Testament, I tell students that. I'm actually teaching in a secular environment, so I can't take a confessional position. But if I was teaching this in a seminary, I certainly would want my students to know that the authorship of Ephesians has been challenged, but there's every reason to support Pauline authorship of Ephesians and to defend that. But anyways, that really wasn't what he's writing. He's writing about the fact that in his seminary, he had been exposed to textual criticism. I'm sure that the modern critical text was promoted. I'm sure that if he learned Greek, that they were using the Nestle-Aland 28th edition. And he was probably told, you know, here are some problems with the traditional text, and here's the way the modern critical text has supposedly improved it. Anyways, I'm just glad that he maybe found some of the material that I've put out, including the article on the ending of Mark, that's made him question whether or not it was a wise decision to put brackets around 16:9-20 or insert the so-called shorter ending, which is only makes an appearance in a few manuscripts very late. Why is it included in modern translations of the Bible? It's completely inappropriate. Even Westcott and Hort didn't go that far. But anyways, so I'm encouraged to hear that kind of feedback. So I want to go back, though, and I want to look at briefly at another feedback that I got on the article. And this one I got very quickly from Dr. Peter Gurry. And Dr. Gurry has a PhD in text criticism. He is one of the current leading experts on the coherence-based genealogical method, has studied that, did his dissertation on that, has now produced a couple of articles and even a short book introducing the coherence-based genealogical method to English-speaking audiences. And he also regularly blogs at the Evangelical Text Criticism blog. And anyways, I had shared my paper presentation with him that I'd done in Houston. We'd gotten into touch with each other, and he requested it, and I sent it to him. And then I had sent him my article when it came out, and he gave me some feedback. I really appreciate the feedback that he gave me, the time that he took to look it over. Again, he teaches at a Phoenix Seminary in Arizona. And by the way, Dr. Gurry is one of those persons who does not believe that Mark 16:9-20 is written by the same person who wrote the rest of Mark, written by Mark. He doesn't believe Mark 16:9-20 is original, but he does believe that it is inspired and that it is canonical. It should be part of the canonical text. So He takes, with that regard, the same position actually that Bruce Metzger does. If you read Bruce Metzger's book on canon, when he deals with Mark 16, 9 through 20, he says, I don't think it's original. I don't think Mark wrote it. But I believe it is should be part of the canon. Oddly enough, there are many evangelicals who take a much more radical stance than Bruce Metzger did. John MacArthur takes a much more radical stance than even Bruce Metzger did. He wants to completely reject Mark 16, 9 through 20, says it's spurious, says it's not inspired, says it shouldn't be part of the New Testament, and shouldn't be the basis for any authoritative doctrine or teaching. So oddly enough, we're in a situation where we have evangelicals taking more radical stances than some of the text critics, the modern text critics. Anyway, so Peter Gurry gave me some feedback, and I want to address this question that he raised, and it relates to several things. We're going to eventually focus on the questions he raises about the Syriac evidence for the ending of Mark. So he wrote to me and said, I noticed in your paper, there is no mention of the Sinaitic Syriac. Was this intentional? Its text is, per Metzger, as early as the late 2nd, early 3rd century, and it lacks the longer ending. This is a problem for your claim on page 39, that there is no, quote, inkling of controversy, end quote, in this period. I note this manuscript is also missing from the extended quote of Lunn at the end, that a long quote from Lunn's book on book-length treatment of the ending of Mark, defending its authenticity and originality. Anyways, he said, I also noticed that there was no mention in my article of the Sahidic Coptic or manuscript, he puts 308, it actually should be 304, cited in the Nestle Alon 28th edition. So again, I really appreciate the fact that Peter Gurry took the time to read the article and offered his feedback. So he was saying, okay, his main point seemed to be, okay, in your article you said there's no inkling of any evidence pre-300 for any controversy over the ending of Mark. But, he says, what about the Sinaitic Syriac, which doesn't have the ending of Mark? And Metzger dates that to 2nd or 3rd century. And what about the Sahidic Coptic? And what about this manuscript 30, he calls 308, but it's actually 304. It's an honest mistake. Anyways, so I wrote a response to him, and we had some back and forth on there. And with his permission, I asked if we could, if I could post our back and forth onto my blog, and he graciously agreed for that. And so I posted a response to him. And by the way, I'll have a link to that blog post also on this one on WM 98. But anyways, let me just review what I said in response to his query. So again, this is from my blog post. I said, my main focus in the article was to survey the Greek manuscript evidence for the traditional ending. So I did not give much focus to the versional evidence. That is the evidence from versions or early translations of the New Testament. Of that versional evidence, I added that it is extremely scanty. There's extremely scanty evidence from the versions for the ending of Mark that is pre-300. I said, if I revise the paper, I will try to add something on the Sinaitic Syriac. And if Peter Gurry, who's an expert in the field, has a question about this, and certainly I want to address it. So if I ever get an opportunity to expand the article, to print it, publish it, maybe in some other venue, I will certainly add something. But then I said, of this question about the Sinaitic Syriac and the ending of Mark, I suggested notice two things. First of all, if you look at Metzger and Ehrman, and by that I mean the fourth edition now of Metzger's very influential work called The Text of the New Testament, subtitled Its Transmission, Corruption, and Restoration. And that subtitle says everything about what Metzger and Ehrman believe. And sadly enough, many evangelicals like James White and others believe about what text criticism is doing or what has happened to the text. It was transmitted, it was corrupted, and it must be restored. It must be, reconstructed by modern text critics. But anyways, this book has been very influential. The most recent edition of it is now the fourth edition. And after Metzger, I don't know if it was published, this fourth edition was after he died or before he died, but his student, Bart Ehrman, and Ehrman has taken it on. And so in 2005, this fourth edition is looking at it. The first edition was 1964, second edition, 1968, third edition, 1992, and the fourth edition is 2005. So with the fourth edition, the first three, of course, were just Metzger. The fourth edition lists Bart Ehrman as a co-editor of it. But anyways, I point out that in Metzger, Ehrman, fourth edition, they say that the Sinaitic Syriac was copied in the fourth century. So this would be post 300 according to their own dating. Although they speculate that it preserves, as they put it, quote, the form of the text, end quote, from, quote, the beginning of the third century, end quote. That's on page 96. So my point in response to him is, Metzger and Ehrman say that the Sinaitic Syriac wasn't copied until the fourth century, although they speculate that the form of the text that it represents, it goes to the beginning of the third century. Now, I point out to him, there's no footnote or source that is cited by Metzger and Ehrman. This seems to be speculative to me at best, so I did not include this as a sure or certain pre-300 witness to the ending of Mark. So I'm kind of defending the fact that I didn't deal with the Sinaitic Syriac in a discussion of the pre-300 Greek manuscript evidence for the ending of Mark. Secondly, I said to him, Metzger and Ehrman, again in the fourth edition of the text of the New Testament, also note that the Sinaitic Syriac, a palimpsest, which means it's a manuscript that was scraped off, the ink was scraped off, and another to save paper, and another manuscript of some sort was copied over it. And only later did they discover the palimpsest text, the older text underneath what was written over it. It was not discovered at St. Catherine's Monastery on Mount Sinai till the year 1892. This is pointed out by Metzger and Ehrman on page 96. This means that this document, Sinaitic Syriac, had absolutely no bearing on Westcott and Hort's decision to end Mark at Mark 16:8 when they published their groundbreaking 1881 Greek New Testament, which is kind of the mother of the modern critical text. This decision by Westcott and Hort was based on the evidence of the two great uncials. It was based on the evidence of Codex Sinaiticus and Codex Vaticanus, not on the Sinaitic Syriac. And so a point I was saying to defend my not addressing this is it doesn't date to pre-300. And it was not its discovery in 1892 and later publishing of it and knowledge of it circulating in scholarly circles, that came after decisions had already been firmly made about the authenticity of Mark 16, 9 through 20. So it was not influential in that regard. As for the Sahidic Coptic, the Nestle Alon 28th edition apparatus puts the little superscript MS, which means that they are suggesting that there are only a couple, two or more Sahidic Coptic manuscripts that supposedly do not include the traditional ending. The Nestle on 28th edition apparatus does not identify those manuscripts. And then I went back and I read the discussion on this in Metzger and Ehrman on pages 110 to 112, They do not cite any Sahidic manuscripts that are pre-300. So the Sahidic Coptic manuscripts do not provide any versional evidence for the ending of Mark pre-300. As for what Gurry mistakenly calls manuscript 308, it's actually 304. The reason I did not include that in my analysis was twofold. First, I learned from James Snap that the ending of this manuscript is apparently damaged so that it is not a valid witness for the ending. The fact that it doesn't have Mark 16, 9 through 20 is most likely due to the fact that the last leaves of it were damaged and not that it didn't actually include the traditional ending. Also, in any regard, according to the Nesselon 28th edition, this manuscript, 304, should be dated to the 12th century. They date it to the 12th century. So 304 is not relevant for the pre-300 discussion of the ending of Mark. Let me go on to say in response to Gurry, I said, I tried to stress in the article that my overall focus was on the Greek manuscripts. And I did this in the first line of the second paragraph on page 35 of my article when I wrote, quote, upon examination of the early Greek manuscript evidence for the ending of Mark, one can tentatively suggest at least three distinct periods or phases in the early transmission of the ending of Mark. So maybe I should have put more emphasis on this, but my article, although I do make a few references to versions in the article, my main focus was on the Greek manuscript evidence. So on page 39, I made this statement regarding the pre-300 evidence for the ending of Mark. I said, quote, if we had only the evidence from this period, we would hardly have any inkling of controversy over the text of Mark, but would assume the traditional ending as the undisputed conclusion of the second gospel, end quote. And then I said to Dr. Gurry, I said, in light of the evidence, I think this statement in my article on page 39 is accurate. We do not, for example, have any patristic evidence of any dispute about the ending, which we do find in post-300 authors like in Eusebius and in others. And I make the point in the article that I published as well, there is no papyri evidence. There's absolutely zero early papyri evidence for the ending of Mark. James White loves to say, oh, the papyri makes all the difference, and thank goodness for the papyri, because he mistakenly believes that the papyri evidence has simply supported the decisions of Westcott and Hort. That's just simply not true. If you listen to the last Word magazine that I did on Peter's confession in John 6:69, that is an example of how the papyri evidence does not necessarily support the decisions of the modern critical text. P66 and P75 do not give an account of John 6:69 that's in agreement. According to Westcott and Hort theory, they base their texts on the Uncials, on Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, which actually don't agree with each other in all cases either. But anyways, according to their theory, finds of earlier manuscripts like the papyri would substantiate their decisions, and there would be this original that would date back, closer back, and they would all be in agreement with the so-called Alexandrian text. But as we've discovered the papyri, we found that there is as much variety in the papyri readings as there were in the Uncial readings, and they do not provide uniform support for the so-called Alexandrian readings or for the modern critical text. And this is an error that James White and some others continue to propagate, that the papyri evidence supports. And with regard to the ending of Mark, there's no papyri evidence. So we have no pre-300 Greek manuscript evidence for the ending of Mark. We only discover the controversy post-300 And yes, we do discover that there was controversy over the ending of Mark in the uncials like Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, but we have no pre-300 Greek manuscript evidence for it. So anyways, that's a review of Gurry's questions that he posed for me about my article and my responses to them. Now, I want to move on and I want to review again the three periods that I traced in that article, my article on the ending of Mark as a canonical crisis, the three periods in the transition or the transmission rather of Mark's ending. So in the article, I suggested there were three distinct periods in the early transmission of Mark's ending. The first period I called the emergence period, and that was the period from the writing of the Gospel of Mark, whenever that happened. We don't know when it happened, but in the first century, I obviously would tend to date it much earlier, so maybe in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, Mark is written. And so this emergence period, I would date all the way up from the writing of Mark up to 300. Okay. The second period that I traced, I called the disputed period. And that would be from the year 300 to the year 500. And this is when we really see evidence that the ending of Mark was being contested, whether it's in the uncials, Sinaiticus of Vaticanus, or it's in the writings of Eusebius. In his letter to Marinus. So we see evidence there was controversy about the ending of Mark. And then the third period that I point out in my article, I called the consensus period from the year 500 to the year 1900. And that was when the dispute had taken place for about 200 years. And then there came to be a consensus that the so-called traditional ending of Mark, Mark 16, 9 through 20, was the fitting, proper, authentic ending, and the manuscripts support this. It becomes the reading of the majority text, and so I called this last period the consensus period. Then finally, my paper, although I don't name it the fourth period, I essentially do suggest a fourth period, and that would be the current era, from 1900 up to the present. And this would be the age we're in now, in which that consensus that's lasted for at least 1400 years from 500 to 1900, the consensus that the traditional ending of Mark is authentic, that is being challenged. And again, oddly enough, not only is it being challenged by liberal mainline Protestant scholars, not only is it being challenged by atheistic or agnostic secular academics, but strangely enough, it's also being challenged by Orthodox, evangelical, Reformed Christians. So those who challenge the traditional ending of Mark, who are doing this in the modern period, I think realize that one of the weaknesses, glaring weaknesses of their position is that there is no clear pre-300 evidence for any challenge to the traditional ending of Mark. There's no papyri evidence. There's no patristic evidence. And by the way, on the other side, if, again, you can go back to my article, there's a lot of pre-300 evidence, particularly patristic evidence and early writings, apologetic writing, evidence from the church fathers that supports the longer ending. It's there in Justin Martyr. It's there in Irenaeus of Lyon. And so this is an embarrassment to those who want to say that the traditional ending of Mark is spurious, that it's late, that it's not authentic. So they have no evidence supporting, let's say, Mark ending at Mark 16, 8, that's pre-300. But we do have evidence, patristic evidence, that supports a traditional ending that is goes back to the early second century. So I think this dilemma for those who have rejected the traditional ending of Mark has made them willing to stretch the versional evidence, the evidence from the early translations, as far as they think it will go. And this has included speculations that are sprinkled in by Metzger and Ehrman about the Syriac evidence, including, again, the Sinaitic Syriac, which we're going to discuss in a moment. Again, Metzger and Ehrman date it to the 4th century, but as Gurry put it in his note to me, it's really interesting. Notice what Metzger wrote, and then notice that how Gurry, in his note to me, interprets Metzger, and he says, "Oh, it's Metzger dates it to the late 2nd, early 3rd century." But that assessment, it seems to me, rests again on a very shaky foundation, and this is another example of, I think, scholars sort of attempting to fit or stretch the evidence to fit their presuppositions. They don't believe Mark 16, 9 through 20 is authentic and original, and so they stretch the evidence, the versional evidence related to the Syriac, to fit their preconceived conclusions. So I want to turn now and look at the apparatus to the Nesselon 28th edition and see what it says about the Syriac evidence for Mark's ending. And I guess I probably, before I even start discussing this, I should. I'm assuming most people who are reading this have you know, some sense of some of these terms and things we're discussing. What do we mean by the Syriac? Well, the Syriac was an ancient language, a language that was spoken by people in the area of Palestine. And it was, again, an ancient language. There still is a vibrant Syriac church that exists in those regions. And so there was a vibrant Syrian Christianity that used this language, Syriac. It would have been in Lebanon, in Egypt, various other parts of Mesopotamia, even as far as India and China. And so the New Testament was early on translated into this Syriac language. So anyways, if you look at the apparatus of the Nesselon 28th edition, it says, first of all, that the traditional ending, Mark 16, 9 through 20, is actually found in, it lists three Syriac traditions. First, it's in what is called the Curatonian Syriac, and that is a single manuscript. We'll talk about that again in just a moment. Secondly, it's found in what is called the Peshitta Syriac, and this is the Vulgate Syriac. This is the ecclesiastical Syriac, the Syriac that prevailed and became the most widely used. And as in the Greek tradition, the traditional ending prevailed in the Textus Receptus of the Syriac. And it also mentions that it is in what is called the Harclean Syriac. The Harclean Syriac, according to Metzger and Ehrman, was an edition that was issued of the Syriac Bible in the year 616 by a fellow named Thomas of Harkel, or the ancient city of Heraclea. And so that's why it's called the Harclean Syriac. So let's be clear about this. The traditional ending of Mark is in the Curatonian Syriac. It's in the Peshitta Syriac. It's in the Harclean Syriac. Well, in what Syriac tradition is it omitted? It's omitted in, according to Nesselon, 28th edition, it's omitted in one tradition, and it's called the Sinaitic Syriac. That's what Gurry made reference to. And you might ask, well, what is the Sinaitic Syriac? Well, the Sinaitic Syriac is one single manuscript. One manuscript. Okay? And so I'm going to turn now, and I look through Metzger and Ehrman's, again, 4th edition, this book that's very influential. Seminarians are still reading it. Those preparing for ministry, pastors, is the thing that they're most likely to read, and it's most likely to shape their thoughts about text criticism. The text of the New Testament. Anyways, this is what they said. They have a discussion of the Syriac on pages 96 to 100. So they note in that there are five different Syriac versions of all or part of the New Testament. And then they list them from the oldest to the youngest. And they list the following. First of all, they say there's the Old Syriac. Secondly, there's the Peshitta, the Vulgate. Next, there is the Philoxenian. And the Philoxenian dates to the year 508. And then there's the Harclean, which dates to the year 616, again, Thomas of Harcle. And by the way, let me just read briefly what they say about the Philoxenian and the Herclean. Metzger and Ehrman say on page 99, one of the most confused and confusing tangles of textual criticism involves the unraveling of the Philoxenian and or the Harclean versions. So the Philoxenian and the Harclean are related to one another. They were both issued by bishops in the same region, and so they're related to one another. So we've got the Old Syriac, the Peshitta, the Philoxenian, the Harclean, and then finally they mention the Palestinian Syriac. So there are five different Syriac versions. So we're interested in the Old Syriac, what they say about the Old Syriac, because this will supposedly give the oldest evidence for how the Syriac manuscripts read, going even earlier than the Peshitta. So they note that the Old Syriac, this is page 96, is preserved today in two manuscripts. So we're talking about interpreting two manuscripts. The first of these is called the Curatonian Syriac, which I mentioned earlier. This includes the traditional ending of Mark. This is, according to Metzger and Ehrman, a parchment manuscript that is found in the British Library. It got its name, the Curatonian Syriac, because it was edited by a British scholar named William Cureton in the year 1858. And again, if we go to the oldest Syriac, we've only got two manuscripts, and one of them, the Curatonian Syriac, includes a traditional ending. The second manuscript is the Sinaitic Syriac, which does not include the traditional ending. And again, it's described by Metzger and Ehrman on page 96 as a palimpsest manuscript that Agnes Smith Lewis discovered in the monastery of St. Catherine on Mount Sinai in 1892. I already mentioned this. So that's why it's called the Sinaitic Syriac, because it was found in St. Catherine's monastery. This is the famous monastery where von Tischendorf discovered Codex Sinaiticus, the unsealed Codex Sinaiticus. And by the way, we might wonder, given that it was found in the same monastery where Codex Sinaiticus was, whether or not this old Syriac manuscript, the Sinaitic Syriac, whether it could have been translated either directly from Codex Sinaiticus or from a related manuscript, one that was similar to Codex Sinaiticus. So definitely there was a tradition that dates at least to the 4th century, supposedly, when Codex Sinaiticus was created, that omits the traditional ending of Mark. But could the Sinaitic Syriac simply have been a translation of that? I don't know. The description, then, that Metzger and Ehrman give on page 96, and again, this really goes back to Metzger. I think it's probably only been lightly edited, if at all, by Ehrman, this part of it. But anyways, when I read this, I thought, this is just vintage Metzger. This is vintage Bruce Metzger. And by the way, you can find my earlier Word magazine. I forget the number right now, but you can look it up. Search for it on sermonaudio.com, where I did a biographical sketch of Bruce Metzger, probably the most influential person certainly in the 20th century on evangelical and reformed understandings of text criticism, and was very influential in causing many to abandon the traditional text and embrace the modern critical text. But anyways, I've talked before about how Metzger, you've got to be very careful when you read him. He puts so much nuance and I think writes, I don't want to accuse him of being deceptive, but You've got to be careful when you read him. Anyway, this is kind of vintage Metzger. Here's his discussion of these old Syriac manuscripts, the Curatonian and the Sinaitic Syriac. He says, though these manuscripts were copied in about the 5th and 4th centuries respectively. Let me just pause there for a moment. So he says, these manuscripts were copied about the 5th and 4th centuries respectively. And if you look at the context, when he says the fifth, he had described first, for some reason, the Curatonian. It's kind of odd. Why didn't he start with the Sinaitic Syriac and then the Curatonian if he assumes the Sinaitic Syriac was earlier? But anyways, he dates the Curatonian Syriac that includes a traditional ending to the 5th century, and he dates the Sinaitic Syriac to the 4th century. But he gives no reason, no explanation. He provides no supporting footnote for this dating decision. Why? What's the evidence? Why would you think that the Sinaitic Syriac is older than the Curatonian Syriac? And my question is, does this simply reflect his bias that the earliest manuscript must be the one that omits the traditional ending? Because he has a presupposition. He thinks the traditional ending isn't original. So the Sinaitic Syriac doesn't have it. So it must be earlier. The Curatonian Syriac has it, so it must be later. That seems to be how his reasoning is going. He presents no evidence. It's just a total speculation. And so this is an example of circular reasoning. You know this logically. This is a circular reasoning. This is proving your presupposition. So he continues, quote, the form of the text that they preserve dates from the close of the 2nd or beginning of the 3rd century, end quote. So he says they were copied in the 4th and 5th centuries, but he says they preserve a text, a form of the text that goes to the 2nd, be the 100s, or the beginning of the 3rd century, the early 200s. But again, when I read this, there's no reason given, no explanation. There's no supporting footnote to any book or article. How is this anything more than speculation? How is it that if we have these copies of these old Syriac manuscripts, well, I guess we could say, yes, they must be based on some manuscripts that could go back, but how do we know? It may be it's coming from, you know, scholarly reconstructions of Tatian's De Tesserone. I'm sure there's some scholarly stuff there, but Metzger doesn't make any argument. He doesn't provide any argument. He doesn't provide any evidence. He just asserts this. And then he adds, page 97, he says, when the two manuscripts, meaning the Curatonian Syriac and the Sinaitic Syriac, are compared, it is seen that the Sinaitic Syriac represents a slightly earlier form of text than does the Curatonian, even though in some places it may have corruptions that the Curatonian has escaped. And again, this is vintage Metzger. No reason, no explanation, no supporting footnote is given. We are apparently expected to accept his word as the expert that the Sinaitic Syriac presents a slightly earlier form of the text, whereas the Curatonian must be later. But again, is this begging the question? Is this circular reasoning? Is he assuming the Sinaitic Syriac is earlier because it doesn't have the traditional ending of Mark? He's assuming the Curatonian Syriac is late because it does have the traditional ending of Mark. And I'm focusing in on the ending of Mark. You'll see in the discussion, he's not specifically talking about the ending of Mark. He's talking about, you know, he's taking into consideration, I'm sure, other textually disputed issues. And he's basically saying, I think that he thinks the Sinaitic Syriac is earlier because he finds more readings there that support the modern critical text. Although he says it might have some corruptions that aren't in the Curatonian. Those would be places where the Sinaitic Syriac would support the traditional text. He would think of these as corruptions. So if you get my point, is you got to read Metzger with discernment. Again, the reasoning sometimes by Metzger and others seems to be something like this. They would say, here's the first proposition. They would say Mark 16, 9 through 20 is late and spurious. This is what they assume. Then the second proposition would be the Curatonian Syriac has Mark 16, 9 through 20. And then here, this will be the concluding proposition. Therefore, the Curatonian Syriac must be late. But again, I hope you're seeing that this is a fallacious argument. It's based on a presupposition that first proposition, Mark 16, 9 through 20, is late or spurious. And this is an unproven assertion. And then they take that as the basis to make all their other conclusions. So it's faulty reasoning. It's faulty logic. All right, let me draw some conclusions. And I jotted down five conclusions from this analysis of the ending of Mark, the Syriac, and also Bruce Metzger's commentary upon the Syriac. First conclusion, one should be very careful when reading Bruce Metzger's presentation of the data and his analysis of it. One should ask questions about how Metzger's presuppositions about the text have shaped his speculations about the evidence and its significance. So one should be very careful when reading Metzger, and I should say Metzger and Ehrman now, if you're looking at the 2005 edition of the text of the New Testament. Second conclusion, one should be aware that those who reject the traditional ending of Mark may be willing to stretch the versional evidence to support their conclusions. Again, one should be careful and take note of how the versional evidence has been stretched. Third, if one who rejects the traditional ending of Mark gives as a reason its absence in the Syriac, one should respond that it is missing in only one Syriac manuscript, the Sinaitic Syriac. Considering that this manuscript came from St. Catherine's Monastery, it may have been translated from Codex Sinaiticus or a manuscript like it. Even if it is dated to the 4th century, as Metzger and Ehrman assume, it would be post-300. And so it would provide no evidence for pre-300 transmission of the ending of Mark. The only other Old Syriac manuscript, the Curatonian Syriac, does in fact include the traditional ending of Mark. So, I'm sure that if you listen to John MacArthur's sermon in which he rejected the traditional ending of Mark as spurious, I'm sure he says, well, it's not there in the Sinaitic Syriac. And again, I'm saying just apologetically, if you hear that argument, if you're talking with someone and they're sophisticated enough to say, well, it's not in the Sinaitic Syriac, you should respond by saying, that dates post 300. It was found in St. Catherine's Monastery, may have been, copied from manuscripts, post-Greek manuscripts like Codex Sinaiticus that exclude the traditional ending of Mark, so that shouldn't be surprising. And you should say, well, we do have an old Syriac manuscript, the Curatonia, that does include it. you should just not accept that argument. You should challenge it, is my point. Fourth conclusion, the traditional ending of Mark clearly became widely accepted in the Syriac tradition, as evidenced by its inclusion in the Syriac Peshitta, of which, according to Metzger and Ehrman, we have over 350 manuscripts, and they say of them on page 98 of those 350 manuscripts, several of which date from the 5th and 6th centuries, end quote. We should also note this inclusion is also of interest to us canonically, given that the Syriac Peshitta only includes 22 books. It excludes 2 Peter, 2 and 3 John, Jude, and Revelation. My point is that the Peshitta Syriac gives evidence of an unsettled view of canon, and so they even exclude books like 2 Peter, 2 and 3 John, Jude, Revelation, But they hold and cling to and affirm the ending of Mark as part of the proper canonical text of the Gospel of Mark. And so that seems to me to be an argument, an extra argument for the authenticity of the traditional ending of Mark. If it were part of the anti-legomena, then their rejection of 2 Peter, 2 and 3 John, Jude, and Revelation show that they had a tendency not to include things that were disputed. And so they include the traditional ending of Mark. Fifth, then, and finally, far from arguing against the antiquity of the traditional ending of Mark, I think if you soberly assess the evidence from the Syriac, you find that the evidence from the Syriac actually offers strong support for the authenticity, originality of the traditional ending of Mark. Probably won't surprise you to find that I come to that conclusion. Let me just add one closing thought, just a little extra thought to throw in here. And I want to go back to the note that I got from my Southeast Asian friend who wrote and was talking about the fact that in the seminary that he attended, they were teaching him the modern text criticism. They were challenging the authenticity of a Pauline letter like Ephesians. And, you know, what he presented there, again, is a kind of a typical problem that we have, again, even in evangelical, even in otherwise conservative, Orthodox, even Reformed seminaries. And that has been the embracing of the Enlightenment influence modern historical critical method. And I recently, again, it's a little extra thought here, I recently had someone recommend that I read a book, just came out in 2018, and I actually sat down yesterday. I'd ordered the book, I'd gotten it. It's by Craig A. Carter, and it's titled Interpreting Scripture with the Great Tradition. And then subtitle is Recovering the Genius of Pre-Modern Exegesis. And I'm going to read this. I'll probably write a review of it at some point. But I sat down, actually got home in the afternoon from a good Lord's day and went and sat out on my porch. It was a very temperate day, cool day, and odd for July. And I read the preface to the book. And it's called The Preface and the Acknowledgements. And I thought it was interesting. I was excited, by the concept of this book because the author, who is a professor of theology at Tyndall University College and Seminary in the UK. And so it seemed to be from the title that he's going to challenge the wisdom of the church embracing modern historical criticism, Enlightenment influence criticism. And indeed, when I read just the preface, and again, literally I've only read the first 10, 15 pages of it, of the book, there were a lot of things that sparked my interest. And I'm looking at, this is from the preface, this is page Roman numeral 18. He says this, he says, my hope is, in this book, to overcome the Enlightenment by showing that the Enlightenment movement of higher criticism is a dead end, a sideshow, a deviation from orthodoxy, and a movement that is now in the late stages of self-destruction. And I was like, yes, I love that statement. Yes, I agree with you. So I'm intrigued to read the rest of the book. But then, just after reading that, I started reading the Acknowledgments, which starts on the very next page. This is Roman numeral 19, 20, and 21. And then on page Roman numeral 20, he says this. He says, all scripture quotations in the book are from the English Standard Version of the Bible, unless otherwise noted. I use, recommend, and thank God for the ESV Study Bible, which is a marvelous tool for anyone wanting to study God's Word today. And I hope you can see the contradiction of those two statements I just read. On one hand, he's saying, hey, we got a problem with the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment higher criticism, it's proven to be a dead end. It's a sideshow. It's now in the late stages of self-destruction. But then he says that the translation he plans to use, cite within the book, is the English Standard Version, which is a product of the Enlightenment, which is a translation based on the modern critical text, that its roots are traced back to Westcott and Hort, traced back to their 1881 Greek New Testament, and then to the English Revised Version that was based on it, that was put out in 1885, and to the American Standard Version of 1901 based on that, to the Revised Standard Version of 1952 based on that, the New Revised Standard Version of 1989, and now the Evangelical version of it, the English Standard Version. And he also lauds the ESV Study Bible, and I have it on my shelf and consult it from time to time, but the scholars who are writing there are evangelicals who are using the modern historical critical method, and all you have to do is read the notes and you see that. So anyway, I look forward to reading Craig Carter's book. I'm sure there's some other good points, but I see this, you know, I guess theological schizophrenia, that on one hand you're saying that modern historical criticism has been bad for the church. On the other hand, you haven't applied that yet to the whole issue of the text of the Bible. It's such a foundational thing, the text of the Bible. And I see this in so many evangelicals. They put up hue and cry about the problems of modern liberal theology, but it's as if they believe that none of that affected text criticism, that none of the text criticism that was done in the 19th century and on into the 20th century, that that was safe, that was okay, that was scientific, that wasn't affected by any liberal presuppositions or so forth. So we should just accept that work, and then we can be critical of modern historical critical methodology in other areas outside of text. And I'm just saying that's contradictory. It's time to come to apply that critique to the text of the Bible. And again, I think the ending of Mark is just a beautiful battleground for us to make this point. Anyways, well, I'm glad that we got to get this Word Magazine recorded, and I was thinking of the title. I think I'm going to title it Word Magazine 98, something like the Syriac, the ending of Mark, the Syriac, and Metzger. It'll be something like that. Again, there'll be a blog post at jeffriddle.net where you can read the notes that I have followed in making this presentation. Hope you've enjoyed this episode, and hope you have a great day and a great week. And I will look forward to speaking with you again soon. Till then, take care and God bless.